Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
Since Donald Trump's inauguration in late January, there has been almost frenetic activity aimed at ending the Russian-Ukrainian war. Talks between the United States and Russia, between the United States and Ukraine, between Ukraine and a bevy of European leaders, between the U.S. and some of those same Europeans, and seemingly nonstop summits among the Europeans themselves. Along the way, lots of rhetoric, demands, threats, and arm-twisting, especially by Donald Trump, as he shifts American policy from Biden's whatever it takes to his own demand to, quote, stop the killing, unquote. The problem is that neither Ukraine nor Europe seem willing to follow Trump where he insists on going. However, as important as it is, Ukraine and the war may only be the front man for a much larger issue. A few days ago, a French senator gave a widely quoted speech calling Trump a, quote, traitor, unquote. And France's defense minister said Europe's problem is the unpredictability of our American partner, not the Russians. More bluntly, the EU's foreign minister insisted, today it became clear that the free world needs a new leader. Lots of hardline, even nasty rhetoric on both sides of the Atlantic. Is it all just posturing before calmer heads prevail? Or is there a real chance that we're headed towards the end of the Atlantic alliance? And if so, what does that mean in reality? There are certainly more questions than answers. My guests today bring important perspectives and strong opinions to this discussion. Ana Palacio is former Spanish foreign minister, a parliamentarian, academic, and author. Evgadis Isakis is a Lithuanian business leader, diplomat, and also his country's former foreign minister. Welcome, Ana and Evgadis, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
You are both keen observers of geopolitics and quite knowledgeable about the United States from your personal experiences. So let's start there. What is your core assessment of what's going on in Washington? Ana, why don't you start?
Well, I may be a bit biased because I have been in Washington almost all January and towards the end of February. I have been teaching at Georgetown University. And in my seminar, there were five students that had been affected by the USAID shutdown or by this new approach to young diplomats or to people in the State Department. I think that the pervasive feeling in Washington, seen from the outside, but with connections to what's going on, is a bewilderment. There has been a big surprise. We had Trump number one, and yes, everybody expected Trump number two to be different and to be more assertive, but not this, I think that there is a component of that existed, but exaggerated element of surprise is my motto. I want to be, unpredictable, unpredictability is here. And second, President Trump insists on this. And the second aspect, which is very confusing, is this insistence, this taking pleasure at belittling, looking for submission in the interlocutors. I'm not stopping at anything from insults and to any other rhetoric figure. And this is true in press conference. It was particularly true in the humiliating staging of the conversation with Zelensky. Now, having said all that, well, this is what we have. I think that a month is largely enough to understand that this is what we get. I personally expect that when the second and third tires will be filled, there will be a certain rationalization, not a lot, but and probably a nuances in the positioning of not nuances in the core, but just projections different than they are now, that they look absolutely nullified. And I'm speaking about Marco Rubio or about Walsh. This is important because in the end, what we have been is during a month of a shower, cold or hot, but being bombarded by initiatives that were aimed at surprising, at humiliating, at setting a stage. So this is the way I perceive. My conclusion is that from a European perspective, we have A, to know that we cannot give up on the United States, at least right now. I hope never, but at least right now, it would really be a great mistake to take a confrontational policy. Oh, second thing, obviously, it's not easy to put up with the way, also the content, but the way. And frankly, we cannot listen to those, as we did in the first Trump administration. Don't pay attention to what he says. Pay attention to what he does.
You've got it as I go to you. Anna said there hasn't been much in the way of nuance. And two, suggested that Trump is in fact behaving as though he is not just president, but also foreign minister and maybe national security advisor. It's all about Trump at this point. As you've got us look at the United States, do you expect the administration to become more normal, or is that asking too much?
To recall, remember what Donald Trump was trying to do during the first presidency and what he pledged to do during his second presidency is indeed to rewrite the rules of the game, both internally and externally. And we are dealing now with a personality who has no deep state advisors anymore. You have loyalists who have pledged allegiance not only to this United States, but to the president's policy, and not only to Trump's policies, but also to Trump's way of acting. So for me, as a businessman, his way of acting is very understandable. You know, he continues to act as a real estate developer in Manhattan, although now, governing the biggest country, the largest military in the world, the most advanced economically and technology-wise. And he's now imposing upon the rest of the world a deal-making, contract-making diplomacy. So that is what we are facing now. And I can sense what Anna says, and I can see how many American allies, especially in Europe, are ill-prepared to talk to President Trump in the way he understands and in the way he behaves. We may dislike it. We may have preferred a multilateral diplomacy of Joe Biden or Obama or even both George Bushes, but we are facing now a different sheriff in town, as J.D. Vance said back in Washington, D.C. So myself, being a businessman, but also who spent almost 30 years in diplomacy, including 6 years as a Lithuanian ambassador to the United States, visiting President Donald Trump twice in Mar-a-Lago, I think my concern is that many U.S. allies and most of Europeans, if not all European leaders, have sleepwalked into geopolitical irrelevance, which is now time to catch up. You know, it was all clear. President Trump was very transparent. What kind of policies he will impose vis-a-vis trade through tariffs. Prioritize, first of all, defense and control of the state borders of United States and China as a most acute geopolitical and geoeconomic challenge. He also spoke very blunt and straightforward language that he will impose negotiations between Russia and Kyiv, and that he will not, provide security guarantees to Ukrainians and try to, you know, to freeze the contact border, which is now in place between fighting Ukrainians and the Russians. All of that was known for the last 3 years of the campaign. General Kellogg had published or co-authored the article back about a year and a half ago. So for me, who was following United States politically, economically, and financially, there was no surprise what a sea change President Trump is bringing. I'm surprised and disappointed that European leaders were not prepared to be ready to talk to President Trump already in advance during the negotiation during the election campaign, and now having some leverage and having some incentives for Donald Trump to stay involved in Europe and support Europeans when it comes to security guarantees in Ukraine.
I would agree with you. You say he has said what he is going to do. Frankly, President Trump has said many things that are absolutely contrary, and we all know this is his motto, because what he says, he wants to surprise people. This is his methodology, is the surprise. This is the first thing. The second thing is that, in my opinion, the most important thing that he's doing is dismantling the bureaucracy. Now, we have been, they have heralded the 40 million that were spent, I don't know where, in a country in Latin America for sex change and other, frankly, I find crazy things, not amounting to the thousands of millions that USAID is. Yet, USA has been frozen. I think that let's not exclusively concentrate on what Trump is doing, because Trump, and you are right on this, he has come with a team, and a team that is a very peculiar team that has decided to disrupt the bureaucracy. Now, you speak about diplomacy. No, this is anti-diplomacy. Diplomacy, I agree with you that Trump has the approach of a real estate to everything. I buy your plot, and that's it. And we don't know each other. I don't want relations. Frankly, international relations and diplomacy is on duration, on establishing links that allow you between challenge and challenge, between crisis and crisis, that allow you to have a certain relationship. And he is just blowing all this precisely by this not taking into account a certain respect, certain format, you know, respect in diplomacy, international relations, and in life in general, but it is extremely important. What he has, again, show off is what we have to think It is as observer of international relations, what it is my business is to see how, starting from Westphalia, all the procedures, all the links that have been underpinning the international relations are being upset or simply destroyed.
Anna, that's exactly the point. I'm glad you put it that way, because that is the new American reality. So it isn't a question of should he be doing it or not be doing it. I'm sure the three of us would all argue, oh my God, he shouldn't be doing it, but he is. So we're in a different space. And my question to both of you is, given that reality, what will be the reaction, do you think, of Europe's leadership? Because Trump's not going to change. And indeed, arguably, Trump reflects a powerful current in American thinking, not the traditional alliance thinking, but a powerful thinking, a powerful direction where the country's going.
Let's go beyond the Europeans. Hey, let's address the United States. You know what? Yes, we Europeans, we kind of counted on this dividend of peace, and we lost sight of what hard power is. And that's absolutely clear. If you read what in Europe was being published in the early 2000s, you would see how a lack of reality. We had this idea that Europe would govern the 21st century, that rules being a regulatory power. What does that mean? That there was a Brussels effect, that directives that Brussels approved were followed even by China. All this, yes, this was a mistake about how the world works. But we are here in something that we are not realizing, is that with this President Trump show, and President Trump an acolyte, because of course President Trump is his show, but it's as much Elon Musk's show, and suddenly you see the...
I have to disagree. Musk has nothing to do with Trump's worldview. He's a reflection of it.
But I think that you are right, but I'm speaking about how the United States projects itself. I think that what President Trump is doing, and in a peculiar way, because at the same time that he announces hard power and being hard about the Europeans, there is this program of reducing Pentagon spending 8% and redirecting for 5 years and redirecting it. So what I think is important, and there he has been helped by his surrounding members, particularly, is that soft power is going has disappeared. Now, you know what? When you are the dollar, and when you are all over the world, you have to know that soft power is there, that you cannot just. I'm here in Baku this morning. I had breakfast with a group of Ukrainian, and then a cup of coffee with a group of Africans. You have to listen to what they are saying. Okay, the idea how it has been sold is that they needed to clean the dump, but this is for the voters. And what I hear is that there are more and more voters in that even have voted for Trump that understand that this is going too far. But when you have programs all over the world that have been cut, and as I say, with pretext that we have been told about 10 programs that probably were crazy, okay, but the rest is just has gone. This is something that will have profound consequences.
The Tilburg Foundation has a deep commitment to encouraging global values-based leadership wherever we can find it. With the Tilburg Leaders Mentoring Leaders program, we're looking to identify and nurture emerging leaders with outsized potential. TLML aims to leverage the Tilburg Foundation's global network to accelerate emerging leaders' growth and impact through one-on-one mentoring. Are you someone, or do you know someone, who should be a part of the TLML program? If so, please apply. Applications will be accepted from March 1st. Go to tilburgfoundation.org for more information. Thank you.
What is Europe going to do? And then you've got us. I want to hear you too. Given everything you just said, those are the facts. What is Europe going to do?
I see a Europe reconfiguring in a different way. We are going to revisit, to be short, and go to the core of it. We are going to see different speeds or different groups that will coalesce around Ukraine, in Spain or in Italy. It's extremely difficult to transmit the challenge, the danger that Russia represents. So this is one thing. The other issue is that I hope that we will end up having a new approach to incorporation in the European Union, so to access negotiations, and this is something that is being discussed. There is going to be, all in all, an increase in the defense budget that will happen. But to those that see that Europe will come as a federal state, I don't think so. I think it's going to be long, complicated, and in organizational times, terms, much more complicated than what we have now. At the same time, because Europe is not just that we have this problem of defense, which we do, is that we need to regain competitiveness, which is a big issue. These days, the program before Trump upset everything, including the European Union programs, is that during these days, we should be analyzing how to address the excesses of the Green Deal to bet on European competitiveness. This is getting very little attention. I think if it gets little attention, there will be dangers that this is watered down, because I don't share the approach of getting rid of the administration, but bureaucracies that are absolutely necessary when you want a functioning state or a functioning political. They have their inertias and they have their complexity. So for us, it's an important time, and it will be a renewal and a new formulas that we will see coming.
Degadis, let me ask the same question somewhat differently. Europe is famous for muddling through or kicking the can down the road. A lot of speeches, talking about doing things. Defense spending is not a new issue, obviously. Modifying the Green Deal is not a new issue. The lack of competitors is not a new issue. Do you see anything that we can hang our hat on that this time it's different? This time Europe will do the things that Europe knows it needs to do to be relevant in the 21st century?
I'm not an oracle to predict how Europe left. What I can see, what Europe needs to do, and where I see a certain awakening is taking up after a long, long walk into relevance, is indeed that, four things. First, what Europe needs to do is to beef up its defense industry and build military capacity which would be, I mean, interoperable with United States, but at the same time capable autonomously to conduct military operations from defense of territory of European Union to peacekeeping and peace enforcement missions. We are far, far to that level. Secondly, Europe should play a hard ball against Russia, who was wont to occupy part of Ukraine and continue to impose sanctions so as to leverage Russia to negotiate with Ukraine and to make appropriate compromises. Thirdly, what Europe needs to do is to stay united with Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is not Afghanistan. We've seen how Americans and NATO, I mean, shamefully left the country where I spent my own 4 years and continue to be engaged. Ukraine is part of Europe. And it is our obligation and our responsibility to promote and to contribute to security, well-being, and territorial integrity of Ukraine. And here we should beef up whatever we can to support economically, financially, and militarily. And last but not least, bearing in mind the overwhelming United States military capacity, acknowledging that Europe is unable to defend itself. You know, just, I mean, to quote the Kiel Institute and Rand Corporation study, to defend the Baltic states, where I'm from, and Poland and Finland, the West needs 300,000 combat troops to be able to resist and rebuff potential Russian aggression. Where and when we're going to get those 300 well-trained, integrated, and the command, the same single command and control from European countries? I mean, now we could barely speak about 25, 30,000 not yet known what kind of mission soldiers will conduct in Ukraine. So we will rely upon the United States for a considerable time, because Americans have over 100,000 troops in Europe. They can easily and fast redeploy another 200,000 from the United States and to be in defense, provided the iron commitment of the United States towards NATO stays in intact. And that's why Europeans will have to walk a fine line not to alienate the United States, to keep Donald Trump engaged, however you like it, him or you dislike him. And I hope that Europeans will be acute and sophisticated, not to jump with whatever initiatives which may further, you know, reduce American interest to be engaged. If we start talking about something alternative to NATO, not interoperable with the United States, we may find ourselves in a very difficult situation when we don't have our own army to defend ourselves and we see American commitment moving out. That's, from my perspective, those four key directions of beefing up defense industry and building European army intolerable with Americans. Secondly, playing a hardball against Russians. Thirdly, staying united with Ukraine. And fourthly, walking a fine line and keeping engaged Donald Trump's America with Europe.
As we near the end of this conversation, let me try one other approach. I think it's pretty clear that Donald Trump lives in a great power world. So does Putin, so does Xi. Europe does not. Europe lives in a multilateral, multipolar world. And as the goddess you just said, has a lot of work to do. And then as you said, to get to a point where it is relevant in global power politics terms. But we are where we are. And those gaps between what ought to be done and today's reality are quite real. So as we slip slide towards this world, how do you think, will this create a sense of urgency on the Europeans? Because we've got us, all due respect, I'm not sure Trump's willing to sit around and wait. It doesn't seem to be. And that's the problem.
You're right, Alan. And that's a real problem for Europeans. You know, having worked 8 years for European Commission as EU ambassador to both Afghanistan and Russia, I know how cumbersome decision-making process You know, I remember Jean-Claude Juncker, president of the Commission, tried to introduce a ceiling towards new directives. Maybe something what Elon Musk does in United States may be helpful or should be helpful for European Parliament and European Commission, you know, just to seal new directives and instead, you know, to simplify implementation of those decisions which were made just recently about, you know, unlocking 800 billion euros for defense. So I don't see any more important task than to simplify decision-making process in Europe so as to not only unlock, but, I mean, you know, start using those 800 billion euros, which you have to, I mean, you know, primarily those as loans. What the European Commission has done with the member states, they just removed the ceiling to get extra loans and then, you know, in terms of defense stations. So it's about simplification and about the sense of urgency, which not only Commission but the member states, for sure, the Baltics, Poland, Scandinavians do feel that, and we're going to move fairly quickly.
Anna.
If we try to identify the biggest challenge today is to convince Europeans that this is that what's going on in Ukraine is an existential war for people in France, people in Italy, people in Spain, people, you know, in Portugal. This is not done. This is why, on the other extreme, you see Poland mining its frontiers, mining its borders, getting out of the Ottawa Convention, which is contrary to this idea of having a European Union where we are together. I think that we are going to go through a complex time. It's easy to say that we have to rebuild our industry. It's not that easy to bring that to fruition. I think that what is absolutely clear is that we depend on the United States, but that many different heads of state and government have said that they won't send troops to Ukraine unless there is a security guarantee. And the United States say that they will not give the security guarantee. So there is a lot to be discussed. It is true that the atmosphere in the Baltic state, in Finland, in Poland is completely different. But this we need to approach. I think that right now saying that we need to simplify and this has been put in the back burner. What we need is to get our act together to understand that this is a strategic and existential threat and start acting. I fully subscribe what Draghi was saying the other day to the European Parliament. I said to this, you didn't. I said to that. But, well, don't do what I say, but do something. I think that we are there. It's not easy because the procedures are contrary to these fast decisions that we need.
Anna, you've written recently quite eloquently and in print in what you just said, it's there as well, that Europe is at a Churchillian moment and you need a Churchill. Do either of you see any leadership that's going to accomplish everything you both said needs to happen?
You know, there is never a second, and I don't think, but Merz, because, Churchill was Churchill, but it had the British Empire behind. The closest is to have a proactive Merz. The problem with Merz is that he needs to start having a coalition with the Social Democrats, which will have consequences in all these areas. And there we are. When Europeans at a corner, we tend to react somehow or other, sometimes in unexpected ways. I wish that we do that. And I wish that we understand that it's the moment not to be us I have defended procedure, but not to be drowned in procedure, which is what's happening to us now.
You've got its last word, leadership.
You know, yes, we need leadership in Europe. I think inevitably it's going to be a British Prime Minister who still enjoys special relationship with the United States. It's going to be Emmanuel Macron, who somehow, you know, manages his own contacts with Donald Trump. And inevitably, it's going to be new Chancellor of Germany, Mr. Merz, who represents not only the largest economy in Europe, but also I think may find a more commonality in terms of communication. Himself having worked for the U.S. financial sector, he may find a way to communicate in deal making and contact making with Donald Trump.
You're diplomats by training and experience. I'm not. I've got to say that I didn't hear a Churchill in that list. So I think we'll continue looking for, as you both said, we know there's need for action. We're going to be looking for some action. And I'm afraid that Trump is going to continue to try to take advantage of European weakness. That may indeed produce something down the road. I want to thank both of you for this conversation. I think what we've done is identified lots of problems, and we wait to see who will grab the lever and actually act. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.